if you're in this room but you're not in senior design or intro to engineering, you need to leave. I think everyone here is here. And I would like to meet with the honors students after class for a few minutes. So how did the first week go? So what was due today? Okay, and how did the baseline schedule go? Okay, that was easy. It's the first semester we've actually done this because it took us a while to get Microsoft Project in place, but hopefully you'll find this to be a helpful experience. So the idea with the schedules now is that you're going to keep these updated on a weekly basis, and we're at several points throughout the semester. We're going to grade them and expect to see status and so forth on your schedules.
Each time we update, do you want a new one uploaded? Same bounty, just different versions?
Yeah,
Update the same schedule?
It's up to you whether you generally, what I suggest is that you revision the file names and you put only the most recent revision under your deliverables link, and then you have an archive section where you have all the previous versions.
Okay.
That way, when I go to the deliverables page, it's clear what has to be graded.
Okay.
Speaking of revisioning and such, backups. So one thing I usually don't talk about early enough, but I want to remind you about is make sure you back up your computers. And the website can actually serve as one way that you back up stuff about your projects. Invariably, we have somebody's laptop crash a few days before final presentations, and they lose data. I had two semesters ago, I had a team that had everything on their iPhone. And they lost their iPhone. And they had no backups. So, and that was the days before we did websites. So, if you're not familiar with websites like Dropbox or that kind of thing, make sure that you are doing proper backups of your websites. Make sure there's multiple copies and that kind of thing. So, what was due today was the project report cover page, the title, the abstract, and the project schedule, and we will get those graded sometime this week. Usually, you will have those grades before next week's class. Typically we get those out pretty quickly, and what'll happen is your team, the email list for your team, the listserv alias for your specific team, will send a mail to that, and in that mail we'll attach the graded rubric, and some comments will be in the rubric. Sometimes we'll return a marked up document. It just depends on the assignment. And then the Microsoft Project schedule, will actually download that and run it and check the actual schedule. So you're putting the MPP document up there, right? So no problems with Project. I'm amazed. Or people haven't gotten that far into it, but this is good. Okay. So do update the Microsoft projects. You see, for example, in the fourth week, project schedule checkpoint, that's a point when we'll ask that your Microsoft project document, you have status updated so you can tell us what percentage of the project is complete, what percentage of the tasks are complete, all that kind of stuff. So next week, we have the problem statement and the meeting logs checkpoint. So the meeting logs checkpoint, again, we'll just go to your website and expect to see somewhere on your website documentation on the meetings that you've held thus far. The problem statement, you know the requirements for that, 2 pages, at least minimum of 2 pages. four major sections that we discussed last time. So hopefully that's clear. Okay, any other questions or business before we talk about design today? No, okay. So things going along okay so far? How many teams feel like they actually know enough about their project right now to write their problem statement? Okay. Other than that, things are going along okay. So what's going to happen between now and next Tuesday? Magic? Okay, so the problem statement has been tough for teams at this point in the semester, and that's one of the reasons why we have that assignment. We want you to really have to think about what is the problem you're trying to solve, not what is your approach. One of the challenges in the problem statement is to spend time telling us about the problem and starting with a general problem and narrowing that down to a specific technical problem versus telling us exactly how you're going to solve that problem. So that requires doing background research on your project and understanding the context in which this technology you're trying to develop exists. Now, what I wanted to talk about today, a couple of issues. One is we want to talk about the design process in general, and two, we want to then talk about design constraints. So you may remember some of this lecture. I gave this to you in seminar about a semester ago. And the main thing that I wanted to focus on today in this lecture was this slide. This is what senior design is all about. What is the most important thing that you must convince us of over the next two semesters? The hard question, what we will ask you often, is what is the evidence of design in your project? And that's what students usually struggle with because they're so focused on just building something. People will say, well, if I just build it and it works, I'm fine. But what has to come out in your senior design documents in a really strong way is the process by which you achieved a working piece of hardware. And that often is not a linear process. Often it involves a lot of design cycles. So it's very common to talk about these kinds of processes as what are called cyclone diagrams, where you'll see a bunch of these overlapping circles, meaning that you go through this process many, many times. In Senior Design 2 this semester, in 2 weeks, they have to produce their first working prototype. And most of the students are asking, why do we have to produce that 4 weeks into the first, into the semester? End-to-end working system. And the answer is, because in doing that, what's going to happen? In the process of trying to demonstrate to us a working version of their design, what's going to happen? They're going to figure out there are all sorts of issues that they didn't really understand. And as a result, they're going to have to redesign their product or their system. And it's that redesign process that we're really after. So in this course, we're going to walk through this process this semester, at least most of this, through about prototyping. So we're now you're already beginning to work on the problem statement. You have to have a problem statement to understand what problem you're going to solve. Now, the big problem with the problem statement is oftentimes people will describe their problem in terms of an approach. They'll say, well, my problem is I want to implement, we were working with a solar energy example. I want to implement a solar energy system with this particular type of solar energy cell. I want to and the problem with that is that The use of that particular solar cell is a design choice. There's many different types of solar cells you could use. Their decision to use a particular solar cell really has to come much later in the process. The problem that they're trying to solve in this kind of hypothetical solar cell project is more about trying to generate energy, renewable energy, inexpensively, right? So to work on that project, they have to know something about what are the alternatives for renewable energy. Why is it even relevant to be using solar energy versus some of the other forms of energy? They would also need to know something about what is the typical cost of energy when you talk about fossil fuels, when you talk about wind energy and things like that, and why do you think solar energy could lead to more efficient or more economical energy generation. Then they need to talk a little bit about the cost per watt for solar energy generation and what are some of the factors that influences that. And then continue down that path until they actually establish as a problem generating a certain amount of energy at a certain cost. That's probably what the problem statement for that kind of a project is going to be. So let's look at some of the projects that we have today. Who wants to volunteer their project? Not you guys, because I worked. Somebody else. Okay. So your project is? Pedestrian footbridge. So what problem are you trying to solve?
We're trying to solve the problem of the elevated increase in foot traffic across Temple's campus and try to decrease their involvement with vehicular traffic.
Good. And what are some of the constraints that you're going to face in doing that?
I mean, the construction phase is going to be pretty difficult because we're on Broad Street, heavily congested area.
But what about in terms of the actual design itself? Minimum height requirements, good.
ADA compliancy.
Good.
Different material use and cost.
Okay, what else? What's going to be the hardest part about your...
We're going to have to worry about existing structures there, so we're going to have to make sure it doesn't overlap anything, and we have to basically design it around the entire intersection itself.
Have you met the Architectural Zoning Commission yet?
No.
That's going to be your biggest hurdle, hypothetically, if you're actually trying to do this project. There's very strong restrictions on what kinds of architectural structures you can build on Broad Street, because most of the buildings are historic. So that's going to be a major challenge in this project, is designing a structure that basically can get approved by this commission. And that's a very real-world type challenge. Okay, that's good. How about another project? Okay, your guitar tuner. So what problem are you trying to solve?
I guess how to make everybody's do what I'm going to do with them down for how long the car goes around.
Which is?
Tune a guitar.
So you're trying to build an electronic device that will actually turn a guitar peg and tune a guitar. So what do you think is the key problem in that? And why hasn't this been done before? What? Problem?
Yeah.
So why do humans tune their guitars? Why is this a manual process typically done by a musician? So this is a very personal thing that a musician does, right? So one of your biggest problems is going to be replicating the experience that people currently go through, because this is a very personal thing. Each musician likes their instrument tuned a certain way. And quantifying that in itself is complicated. So in one of the challenges in this particular project is to try to provide an experience that an expert musician finds acceptable. And replicating things that humans do really well, like tuning guitars, is really hard, tuning pianos and things like that. Two piano tuners, for example, can tune a piano and come up with completely different results. A trained musician will prefer a particular person to tune their piano because they like the way that person tunes pianos. So there's a lot of subtlety in this. Okay, so you'll notice as we talk about these problems, we aren't talking about solutions. Their solution is going to use a microprocessor, it's going to use a stepper motor, it's going to use some gears, but that's not their problem. That's their solution. The bridge you guys are building, I think we were saying might use concrete, but your problem is not to build a concrete bridge. Your problem is actually to get the Architectural Commission to sign off on this bridge that you're trying to build. And they may not even like concrete. They may say you have to use stone or something or that kind of thing. So it starts with a problem statement. Now, very quickly, the next thing that you get into, and this is one of the things you're going to have to turn your assignment for next week, which your assignment coming up is the design constraints. Way back, you know, in what we often call the good old days of engineering, like in the 1960s when they decided to put a man on the moon, there were no real constraints. They call it the golden age of engineering because to some extent you could say they had relatively unlimited amounts of funds and unlimited resources but the goal was to, they actually had a constraint, which was by the end of the decade to put a man on the moon. Okay, those are really nice engineering problems. Unlimited budgets, you know, just do it. And engineering was a lot more fun, I'll be honest, when we worked with those kinds of things in the olden days. But these days, everything is about cost, schedule, and performance. You often hear people talk about those as the three essential elements in a project. So everything you do in engineering is going to be constrained. And learning to deliver a solution within those constraints is going to be the key thing, not just building something. In the old days, you could say, particularly with military projects, a lot of technology was developed for the military or for NASA on unlimited budgets, you know, large, very expensive solutions. And then eventually those were transformed into commercial products, right? So you all know some of the stories of Tang, you know, this horrible morning drink. Do we have anybody who drinks Tang in here? Do people still drink Tang? You know, that was a result, billions of dollars spent on developing that for the space program. Last semester we had a speaker come in from NASA who works with a number of our co-op students, and he showed me three pieces of metal connected by some connectors. And this is part of a mechanical system that lifts equipment out of the shuttle bay so that they can actually deploy equipment. So a triangle that consisted of three pieces of metal. They spent tens of millions of dollars building this. Now, most of you in your engineering lifetimes will not get a chance to work on projects that have those kinds of expenses associated with them. You'll be working on very cost-constrained, very time-constrained projects. So the next step in senior design is to establish the design constraints for your project. And this is something that you're going to struggle throughout both semesters because a lot of the course really focuses on establishing these design constraints and then proving to us that your design meets these constraints. These constraints will have particular formats associated with them, and I'll talk about that in a moment, but let me just go through the rest of the cycle. So once you've got your design constraints, now you can begin to actually do the process of engineering design, which is hopefully what you like, what we've all want to be doing. And you will then you'll create and optimize a system to meet those design constraints. Now, one of the areas that I want to improve on here at Temple is more use of computer simulation tools to do these designs. When you get out into industry, most of the designs you do will use computer tools. You will rarely actually build stuff until it's been completely designed and tested in simulation state. So what are some of the design, some of the simulation tools that you're familiar with, that you learned about here in your academic programs? What? AutoCAD? SolidWorks? What?
STAD?
MATLAB. MATLAB's one of the big engineering design tools right now. What else?
How do you feel about Revit?
I'm okay with it. I don't even remember offhand what it is, but I've heard the name before.
Well, BIM.
We have a team working with BIM this semester.
I want to go down that road. I wasn't sure if it was a good program to use for BIM.
Yeah, I mean, I think any and all these are good simulation tools. You can even think of tools like Excel to some extent as a simulation tool, because you can actually do some design trade-offs in Excel. But the point is that a lot of you who do design work will actually do this from a computer terminal. Computer tools have gotten very sophisticated and such. And that allows you to do a lot of design trade-offs to get to the point where you can sort of argue that this design you are planning can actually meet your design constraints and be feasible. I think a good example of this in structural arena, if you look at the way structures are designed these days, I years ago bought one of these little home architect tools and designed a house with it. And it was pretty cool because you could, you know, get a 3D design and you could walk through the house and you could open and close doors and all that stuff. And this was all for $29. I mean, it's just amazing how much value you could get. But what really impressed me about the tool was then you hit a button and it generates a complete materials list. Every last nail, 2x4, electrical outlet for the whole house generated automatically. Then you can take that materials list and get a pricing, essentially give that to a vendor and let them price it up. And now you've got an estimate for the materials cost for the house. That used to be a very laborious process. Today it's been completely computerized. So design tools will be very important at this phase of the project. Also, though, what will be even more important are all of this knowledge you've gained as undergraduate engineers. This is where you're going to put your knowledge of systems to work. This doesn't mean you're going to go into the lab and try things. This means you're going to actually analyze the systems you're working with and try to predict their performance in such ways that you can compare them to your design constraints. So once you've done the design, typically in a simulation state, typically in a major engineering project, as you're doing the design, another team is independently writing test specifications for that design. Now, why is it important that the test specifications, which are going to determine whether you met your design constraints, why is it important that these test specifications be developed independently of the design process? In what sense? Right. So how often have you used a piece of software and found a problem, and you bring it to the person who wrote that software, and they say, well, it always works when I use it. And you say, well, it doesn't work on this particular case. And they say, well, it wasn't meant to work on that case. Or don't use it that way. That's a typical problem that arises because test specifications did not really consider all the ways people will actually use the software. It only considered the way the person who developed the system or developed the software were going to use the software. So typically in parallel with development of the design, you'll actually be doing the test specifications. In fact, in some large projects, these will actually be written along with the design constraints before anything's actually been designed. Test specifications will come from things like ANSI standards and such. They'll come from taking into account how users actually use technology. So the first cell phones that they made were very nice, very compact. But what happened when you dropped these things? They broke. And even today, you can actually differentiate a lot of cell phones by the amount of wear and tear that they're willing to, that they can withstand. Some vendors like are really good at making durable phones. Some vendors favor phones with lots of fancy features. But what all vendors will argue about are issues like, what are reasonable use cases for cell phones? Years ago, when you spilled a laptop, when you spilled a drink on your laptop, what happened? Your laptop pretty much shorted out and died. Today, laptop keyboards have protection so that when you spill a drink on them, they won't actually do anything. You can actually clean them. And that all came about by considering ways that users use laptops in real situations. So the test specifications will involve a lot of different things. What happened when, some of the most striking examples of this in your generation are these catastrophic events, such as when the first time the space shuttle blew up because there were some leaking gaskets. When such a terrible thing happens, what's the first thing that happens immediately after that kind of an event? What? Well, somebody eventually gets fired. The question is, they got to find the person to fire, right? So what is the first question that people ask when such a catastrophic event happens? So when the first space shuttle blew up, of course, nobody knew why, but they eventually traced it down to faulty O-rings that seal the fuel compartments, and there was leaking fuel, and that ignited and all of that. Okay, so the first step is actually to figure out why this thing happened, and that's usually why you'll see if it's a disaster involving an airplane or some flying vehicle, then National Transportation Safety Board will be on site immediately doing their on site investigations and such, and they'll collect data and they'll try to piece together what happened, and they'll eventually figure out sort of what happened, the O-ring linked. Okay, that's sort of the first step, but that's not, you as engineers will now be affected by the second step, which is, okay, who are we going to blame for this? So what happens when they start investigating the cause of this failure? What's the first question that's going to arise? And you see this all the time. The Exxon oil spill, for example, was another better example. When the Gulf oil spill, right? What happened when the platform blew up and oil started to leak? What was the first thing that was said, or what was the first sort of level of analysis on that? In what sense? The blowout things, right? So, of course, the public says, gee, why wasn't someone smart enough to put some device that would stop the oil from leaking when this kind of thing happens? And because it wasn't apparent, actually, the public was not aware of blowout detectors or whatever they... But then it was determined that the blowout detectors failed. They had them there, but they failed. And so when that happens, now what becomes the issue? And you actually saw this unfold with the Gulf oil thing. What's the next round of questions that happen?
Why did they fail?
And how do you answer the question, why did they fail? Who? I heard it over here. Right. Who essentially determined that those detectors passed their tests? Were they tested? Were they maintained? All these kinds of issues. And pretty quickly, you get into issues of what were the test specifications. Because very often, the first feedback you'll get from the vendor is, oh, they passed all of our tests. In fact, here's the documents that you signed off when you accepted purchase of these things, when you purchased these things. And by signing these documents, you agreed that we passed tests. So typically with test specifications, what will happen is you'll have an organization write the tests, and you'll come to meet these kinds of engineers. There are engineers who all that they do are write test specifications for products and things, projects and such. They will write the specs. At some point, you as the designer and you as the test engineer will mutually sign off on a document which says you both agree that these tests are correct and these tests are comprehensive. Then, when the system's actually built, you'll go through formal testing. And there's various stages of that, but at some point you'll actually do a final operational test, and you'll demonstrate that the product meets those tests. Everybody will sign off, and now you'll go build the final product. You'll go deploy those things. But when one of these disasters happen, of course, the tendency is to point fingers. So somebody will point fingers, as happened with the Gulf spill, at the company providing the blowout detectors. And of course, that company is going to very quickly produce their documentation, which says, well, these were tested. They met the tests that you prescribed. And here, you signed off on those tests. So from our point of view, we're not to blame because we delivered products which met the test conditions that you prescribed. And a good example of this kind of a situation was the second shuttle disaster, where they got into all sorts of arguments about the heat shields, and where people came to realize that the test specifications that were written were not really comprehensive enough, and the failure disclosed another thing they should have tested for, but did not realize it. So in the Gulf oil spill, they started to get into arguments about the test specifications and about what were the design constraints for these blowout detectors. And that's where you get into this kind of stuff. And that's where, as engineers, you're actually going to get involved if it's your design, because you'll be the one ultimately testifying in front of the federal grand jury trying to send you to jail if you're working on projects like that.
And another thing, Professor, sometimes within a profession, a product or, you know, a design can be perfectly fine, and yet you could still be subject to liability.
Yes.
Strict liability in products. I was reading a case about an exercise machine. It met ASTM standards. I think ASTM standard at the time was that for 250 pounds, you know, designed the machine, which is 98.5% of the U.S. population, and he tested it up to 440 pounds. Well, someone bought a gift for a 500-pound woman, and she was using the exercise machine, and the thing collapsed. And she sued the manufacturer at Walmart. And they argued, hey, we don't design these things for, worst case scenarios. But the lawyer went in the theory that there should have been a warning there about it.
Right.
And they moved for summary judgment, and the trial judge granted summary judgment, but the appellate court reversed, saying it should go to a jury on that. It just shows that even though it met ASTM standards, it doesn't mean you're out of the woods.
One of the things that you'll lose sleep over as an engineer if you've developed consumer products is, 20 years from now, when somebody dies from some horrible side effect of a product you built, and you didn't realize that at the time you were building it. There are all sorts of issues about the life cycle of a product. And all of those kinds of things get into this issue. Well, you know, we designed it to meet the specifications we were provided. That's one of the things we'll focus on in this class. We won't hold you to task for 20 years from now, I won't come and find you and say, you see, your senior design project caused death. But you do run into those kinds of issues, particularly if you're dealing with things like pedestrian footbridges. At some point, bolts are going to fatigue and structures are going to fatigue, and all these kinds of issues are come into play. There's been a lot of talk recently about the failures of a lot of bridges, or the fact that a lot of bridge structures within the state transportation system are now failing. But the designers of those bridges said, hey, these bridges are actually living beyond their lifetime, their expected lifetime. They were not designed to last this long. That was not a major design requirement. So the test specifications become really important, because that's how you convince us that your design meets your design constraints. Now, I will tell you, in so far working for senior design for many years, this is the part that students have the most trouble with. And part of that is because you just don't have enough time to do testing, because you have so much trouble just getting the system to build. But what's important about demonstrating this evidence of design is showing us through testing that your project meets its design requirements. Designing those tests and then documenting the results of those tests. That's a lot of what Senior Design 2 is all about. Now, at this point in the design process, we're just talking about simulation. So you design, you set up your tests, you then go into simulation mode and show that the system is going to meet those tests in simulation. And this is where computer tools have got pretty sophisticated, whether you're doing structures, electric circuits, or any of those kinds of things. We can give you tools that will allow you to run these tests in software and get a pretty good estimate of the performance of your system. And you'll iterate on that until you get the design right, but at some point then, you've now got a working simulation, you run these tests in simulation state, and you prove that your system is going to meet its requirements. For example, if you're building a motherboard for a computer, you will sit in front of a tool that has an end-to-end simulation of that motherboard. And you will iterate for months on that design. And then finally, when everybody agrees it now meets the constraints, you hit a button and 2 weeks later the board shows up completely fabricated, populated, and everything. In 3 days, actually, if you're doing it quickly. And that's one of the ways in which design has changed. We used to do a lot of this in the laboratory, actually building stuff. But these days, that's not the way it's done. These days, everything is done in simulation state, and then everything is fabbed once you're very, very certain that your design is actually going to work. So you've got your test, you've verified in simulation state that your design is going to work. Now you go into prototyping phase. This is where you actually try to build the first version of this thing that you've designed. When should prototyping start in senior design? Okay, that's a good answer. When do you think it should start?
After prelim design review.
That's pretty good. We have had some, generally speaking, the more successful a team is, when I talk to the successful teams, they will always tell me they started prototyping very early in the course. We've had teams prototype from the very beginning of the course. Now, how do they do that when the design isn't finished? Well, they have a good idea of some of the elements of that design. For example, they know they're going to have to use a piece of software like STAT, or they know that they're going to have to use a circuit simulator like a multisim, or they know they're going to have to use a particular chip development system, and they don't really know how that development system works. So they will actually spend time at the beginning of the first semester working on those kinds of things to build up their skills and build up their knowledge. So prototyping can never be done too early, but typically I think our goal in senior design is to get you to do a little bit of prototyping during the first semester. And that's why we give you a bonus if you're willing to show us prototyped hardware by the end of the first semester. Because the sooner you try to build this thing, the sooner you realize all the problems you hadn't thought about before. So you prototype. Now you do your tests again. Now, what happens when the performance of the prototype is significantly different than the performance of the simulation? Most students in senior design say, oh, that's okay, that's the way it is. Software is not accurate. Things are always a little different.
Change the software.
I sat last semester with one of my teams. We were sitting in the lab, and their multi-sim simulation of a electric circuit was off by about 50% from what we were seeing in the lab. So they had this nice multi-sim simulation, and they had this breadboard with the gobble wires on it. So I said, show me this voltage. They showed me the voltage. I said, that's about 50% different than what the simulation predicts. And what did they say? They said, that's okay. That's the way it is. We spent the next hour. So I told them, basically, tear that thing out, rebuild it, clean it up. We spent the next hour rebuilding, retesting. Eventually, they got the two to match within about 1%. And there were problems. There were actually problems with their design. What they had implemented on the breadboard did not match what was in multisim. So when you see these kinds of discrepancies, to me, that's where senior design really begins. Because now you have to explain how your hardware differs from your engineering analysis. That's evidence of design. So once you get, so you iterate a little bit on this, you get your, now your prototype is working. What happens next? You done with senior design too? Right, but let's say you clear that for your first prototype. So now what happens is you're going to try to actually, we call it productize or harden your design. In the case of an electric circuit, that may mean going from breadboards to actually small printed circuit boards. In the case of structures, that may mean going from a laboratory scale model of the system to actually trying to build some pieces of it to scale. And whenever you do this, whenever you go from prototype to product, again, you have this kind of change in the way the system behaves. And I, you know, over the years, some of the, your best memories of your engineering careers are going to be issues like this. I sat with some microprocessor designers many years ago after we'd spent about $50 million developing essentially a Intel seat-like CPU. It was actually a Sun Spark chip. They had actually prototyped. Everything was simulated. Everything worked fine. They did some limited prototyping, built the production line, started producing chips, took the first few chips off that production line, which were now 9 months behind schedule, which was a big deal back then. The chips didn't work. $50 million investment. The overall fab was going to be about a $1 billion fab. They actually had to analyze why it didn't work. That included doing things like cutting the chips up and looking with microscopes at actually down to the trace level and all that. And then a very interesting process started. They could not at that point actually change too much about the physical design because they were $50 million into this. So instead, what they did is they started to change the software, actually changed the way instructions were implemented on that chip so that they could get around some of the what they knew to be hardware design flaws. And they eventually got the chip to work. And sold them and made lots of money. This little wonderful device, the MP3 players. Do you know how this product started? A manager, I used to work at Texas Instruments years ago, and one of my colleagues who worked in the what was known as the operating group then came to me and said, you know, we produce memories. We produce these really large memories. And about 80% of them come off the production line with some fault. They may have a few bits that don't work. They may have a line of memory or just a small amount of it that don't work. We can't sell these as memory chips because They're defective. But he said, I have this idea that, you know, for an audio recording, if a few bits are off, that's not such a big thing. We just don't have to use that part of a chip. So is there something we could do with these defective memory chips so that we could make money on them instead of just throwing them out? So they started to play around with the idea of putting recorded audio in an, you know, this was many years before these MP3 players, but the idea was that you had these very large memories that were mostly okay and could be used for things like MP3 players. So they started to experiment with how can we use that design but get around its flaws. And that's essentially what happens in this state where you've now tried to productize something and it doesn't quite work like you expect. Now you have to kind of iterate a little bit to get this product to work and to be successful, because the reality is you can't really retool the entire product at that point. So once you've done, you'll typically do one or two spins of this before you're actually done. So after redesigning the hardware a little bit, rebuilding it a little bit, you'll then go through final testing, and then you're done. This process is what senior design is all about, not just the build part. It's demonstrating that you've gone through all these steps and documenting that in your design documents. And I know you're thinking, that's a lot of paperwork. Well, guess what? And I don't think students, thank God you don't know this when you decide to become engineers. Engineering is a lot of paperwork. You will see more paperwork than you ever wanted to in your lifetimes, but that's how we communicate designs. So you'll find most of your projects, whether you're working for small companies or big companies, we'll go through these kinds of design cycles, and your piece of this may be one, you may be an expert in one specific piece of this. And you will then, but you will be involved in these kinds of things for many, many products that you, or systems that you build, because that's just the way engineering is done. There's just so many issues with liability and other things that products and designs have to be go through many checks before they're finally released into the manufacturing. So are there any questions on that? Any comments? Yes.
When do we need the prototype number?
It has to be demonstrated by the last day of class, which is, I believe, May 2nd, I think, is the last day of class, something like that. Now, an important piece of this are the design requirements. And these are described in the design template. So you can read in the design template about the current requirements for these. But these design requirements are split into two groups. The first group we call technical or sort of engineering requirements. And these are, I think, the ones you find fairly easy to deal with. These are things you'll describe the performance of your system in terms of things you can measure, what we call quantitative constraints. You will not say, our software will be good, our system will be fast. You will tell me in specific numbers, our system will operate at, 30 miles per hour, or our system will improve by 10%, some particular specification. The second set of constraints deal with what we call practical or real-world issues. These have become very important today. These are simple, relatively simple things like cost, power, size. Those are all very important these days. Everybody's very energy conscious, for example. But these are also include things like sustainability issues. We had a group looking at wind turbines for the past two semesters. When you put a wind turbine out in the middle of a farm, which is active, doing agriculture, what's one of the environmental issues you're going to be worried about with those wind turbines? Shadow is actually one which has gotten interesting, and strobing and other things like that. But even more so than that. So you're going to plop this wind turbine in the middle of a corn farm or soybean or whatever your favorite,
Birds flying inside the turbine.
That's also an interesting issue, but not what I'm looking for in this particular discussion. That's a good point. That's a good point, though.
Attract birds?
No. More basic.
Plowing through your wires?
What?
Tractors plowing through
your wires? No. That's also a good issue. These are all good issues, but probably even before all of these.
It's taking away space from actual farmland?
No, wind turbines are pretty, that's not the worst of things, the terms of space. They have pretty low footprint. Have you ever seen these wind farms? I mean, they're, they space these turbines pretty far apart, so the impact on the amount of farmland that's farmable is not that great.
How are you going to build it in the middle of an actual?
What happens when it rains? Water hits the wind turbine, spills down the big base, and goes into the ground, right? The same ground where you're raising crops. All right, so you're going to use a really good lead paint because you want this thing to be shiny and look really good, right? You're going to paint some really cool looking logo on it, and what's your problem? What? What's seeping into the ground? Which is chemical, right? Chemical leakage. I was talking with some people from the water department a few months ago about campus. If you measure the chemical content of the water that's leaving Temple's campus, do you know that its chemical properties are much different than the chemical properties you'll find in my neighborhood in Elkins Park? You would not believe all the chemicals you will find in the water leaving campus here at Temple in much higher concentrations than you'll see in most places in the city. Why?
Chemistry labs have to dump their stuff somewhere?
There's that issue. There's certainly the lab, the business of the university. But something I hadn't thought about before. They've actually measured the chemical content by where the dormitories are. What? You see all sorts of stuff in the water because you're putting 5 or 10,000 college students in a very dense area. And you would not believe the chemicals you're seeing in the water because of that.
For example.
I can leave it to your imagination. And I know this is way outside of my area, so I don't wanna but those chemicals actually as you follow the path of that water down to the main sewage plants and reservoirs, you can still see a lot of those chemical traces in the water even when it reaches the main collection points. And people never thought, in my, you know, 30 years ago when I was a student, people never thought about the environmental implications of putting 10,000 college students in a dense place, in a densely packed space. So these design constraints have to address a whole slew, you know, you need to have five of them, but they should pick up on the most significant issues you'll face, like environmental concerns, sustainability, you know, the guitar tuner project, to pick on one. What happens when you throw that in a garbage, in a landfill? If that thing goes radioactive, God knows how you made it. That's a problem, right? And that may only surface 30 years from now. So design constraints deal with these kinds of issues. The technical design constraints talk about how the system will function in a technical sense. It will, you know, be the, it will meet these various user requirements and such. The practical constraints deal more with the real world issues of what happens when you try to manufacture and sell this product. And that includes things like cost and such, but that also includes things like environmental issues. Why do you think a lot of electronics is built in China?
Lacks environmental standards.
Thank you. Got right to it. So people often say, oh, the cheap labor. Certainly true right now, cheap labor. But things are also manufactured in Mexico. You can go 5 miles, I used to live in Texas, and you can go along the Texas border, and you can see American companies moving manufacturing plants 20 or 30 miles across the border. Why? Because a whole bunch of the much laxer environmental concerns. And if you're making things like circuit boards or tires or all this kind of stuff, you've got major environmental issues. My brother-in-law years ago was in the business of plating musical instruments. He bought a factory. This was his big dream to go. The next day, guess who shows up on his doorstep? He bought a factory who was in this business of chemical plating. This is a true story. I like teaching this course because you can tell a lot of really good stories, but this is a true story early on that really influenced the way I think. He buys this factory, invests every penny he has. Guess what happens the next day? Very good. The EPA shows up, and what do they say? They say your plant is sitting on top of a toxic waste dump because the previous owners were dumping chemicals into the ground. And plating of musical instruments is a really nasty process chemically. He was bankrupted because the cost to clean that up was prohibitive. And he did, for whatever reason, didn't know enough to make these kinds of checks before he made the sale. And the EPA obviously was just waiting. You know, they knew it was there, but they were just waiting. I don't remember if the previous owners went bankrupt or something. But anyway, these are the kinds of issues that you're going to deal with, is not just conceiving and designing and building a good product, but it's sort of what happens after that. What are the environmental impacts of actually trying to make that product? Are there ways you can design it so that it can be made more environmentally friendly? Those are very important issues today. We will address these issues in this course. There are other issues. We had a senior design team last semester, my own ECE students, building a blood pressure monitor. In their final presentation, I asked them, how much power do you think this thing is going to dissipate? They said 1 watt. I said, where are you putting this monitor? Well, it's implantable in the skin. We're going to put it in your shoulder. Do you know what would happen if you put a device in your shoulder that was going to dissipate 1 watt? It would basically burn your shoulder. Their design was unacceptable because their power utilization was way off the map for what's allowable in an implantable device. They will never live that one down. So a lot of issues like that we need to take care of. So for this next week, your task this week problem statement and your meeting logs, and then next week, so I'm giving you essentially a two-week lead, you have to produce your design constraints and a narrative describing those design constraints. It's essentially section 2 of the design document. And then we'll also do a checkpoint on your Microsoft project schedule. And on top of all this horrible paperwork I'm asking for every week, you've actually got to spend some time doing your projects. Paperwork is not the only output. That's just a small part of the research and engineering you need to be doing now to understand what it is you're trying to build or design. And I know all that for one credit. But think of that as an investment for next semester, so you survive next semester. Okay, any questions? Okay, so I will see you a week from now. And you'll be hearing from us with your getting feedback on your assignments. The websites, last week, well, the websites went okay. And the dealing with the Microsoft Word template, did that go okay? All right, so if you have questions about Microsoft Word, don't hesitate to, you know, stop by and I can show you most of what I know. Okay, see you next week. If the honors students could wait around, we'll talk just a few minutes more. Yeah, I appreciated that, actually. Thank you.
I'm currently about to start an internship with Lockheed Martin.
Oh, really?
All the security bullcrap.
Yeah. Oh, I'm very familiar with that. Where are you going to be at?
King of Prussia.
Okay, good. Excellent.
Don't know what I'm doing.
Who are you working with? Are you? Do you know Pat Iannotta? Pat Iannotta? Are you?
I do not.
Okay.
Sally Ann Smith is her name. This is the main.
Okay, yeah, I don't know all the people over there yet, but that's great.
Yeah, I'm looking forward.
They're a good company to do an internship with.